Thank you very much for listening. And remember, if you want to be a part of tonight's show and can't get through on the phone lines, well, you can follow me on Twitter at Darkness Radio, or you can hit me up on Facebook as well. And I'll be happy to try to weave your questions in. Or if you just want to email me directly, Dave at darknessradio.com. Dave at darknessradio.com. And I will, again, try to work your questions in through the evening. What scares you? I want to hear your scariest stories when we open up phone lines in a bit. What has really gotten into your head? Scared you? Maybe even became the thing of legend and nightmares in your world. I want to know what makes you tick and freaks you out. So we'll talk about that this evening. You know, I mentioned, Margie, at the beginning of the show, listening to that episode of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell and Dr. Barry Taff, discussing the Entity case and the San Pedro haunting. And I was so unnerved by the telling of that story, even though that story took place like a decade before he was even telling Art Bell about this. I was so unnerved and uncomfortable. I went into my home eventually to go to bed, and I think I slept with every light on in the house. You know, it was that good of a show, that good of an episode, and that good of a topic that it got into my psyche and really kind of held on and unnerved me. Why do you think in the light we're so much more fearless than we are in the dark? I would think the dark would be our savior. We can hide in the dark. We can, you know, have that mask of anonymity in the dark. In the light, everything is exposed.
Yeah, I think that a lot of it has to do with that issue of uncertainty and not knowing what is lurking for us in the dark. Most of our information, like our primary senses, is our eyesight. So a lot of how we understand the world, what we believe to be true, is by what we see rather than, say, what we smell or touch or taste. Those are important, but our primary senses is sight. So when we take that away, you know, we've lost our biggest tool in confronting, overcoming, and responding to threats. So in the dark, you know, we're more vulnerable, and we are less able to quickly respond and know what to do. When I was I spent time in the underground punishment cells at Eastern State, and they are completely dark. I mean, there's no light. And I think that we really take for granted today just how much light is in our life, even in the dark, in a bedroom. You know, you turn off the lights, but you still have the glow of your electronic clock, or even the small light of something charging is enough for us to orient ourselves in space and know what up from down, left from right, and to know where we are. You take that away when we're just in complete darkness, and it can even be hard to figure out, you know, what direction we're looking in, where we are in that space. And so to respond is going to be even harder. So, you know, total darkness, it's an ultimate sense of vulnerability, which is ironic because it can also be a source of peace. If you're in the context of a isolation tank, you know, one of the float tanks or something, and you're trying to meditate. But if, you know, you don't know where you are and it wasn't your choice to be there, it's a whole different story.
We will take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue talking about the science of fear with our guest. And we've got a link up for her website and for her book. So go check it out at Coast to Coast AM. We are back. This is Coast to Coast AM, the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. That's the book that we're talking about this evening. Margie Kerr, my guest. As we continue discussing this, talk to me about some of the actual science of fear. How were some of these tests done, and what has it really told us?
Sure. So there's really two parts of fear that we often kind of combine into one thing, but when it comes to measuring it, it can get very complicated because a lot of different disciplines define it in different ways. But when we look at fear as the threat response, we're talking about what's happening in a body when we go into a state of stress. So whether we're startled or, you know, we might even be thinking about something that really scares us, and we have a response that involves a bunch of different chemicals. So there's adrenaline that's getting our body going into go mode. So our metabolism kicks into high gear. So we're trying to convert as much sugar as possible into energy and get that out to our muscles. And our heart rate is increasing. We're trying to get oxygen also out to our body. There's also neurotransmitters in our brain that are released, like serotonin and dopamine, and they are kind of greasing the wheels, helping us, respond to what is most important. And endorphins, of course, are released, and they're going to block us from feeling any pain should we get hurt. And all of these things are happening to make sure that we can survive, whether that means running or fighting or freezing. It's really helping us to focus attention on survival. That means a lot of the abstract thoughts or, thinking about the groceries or the bills or all of that rumination is going to be pushed to the back burner, and we're just focused and grounded in our body in the present, which is partly why it can be really enjoyable to do fun, scary things, because that response, in the context of safety can feel really good. But fear, if we think about times when we truly feel threatened, it's the meaning that we give to all of these changes. So if it's truly life-threatening, that can be a traumatic, negative experience. So it's all about the context. But the ingredients, I like to think of it like a kitchen, that our body is capable of creating many different meals, but it's the meaning we give to it, the intent. If we feel our body doing all of these things, we feel our heart racing, we have these surges of adrenaline, what kind of meaning are we going to give to that? And that's kind of how we construct or make an experience of fear. And in the moment, of course, you're not thinking about all of this. It just happens automatically. But people really, our threat response, how we respond to stress evolves for every person, over the course of our life. How we respond to these situations can be a very individualized thing.
It's funny too how there's kind of an adaptive sense, and maybe it's a desensitization. God, what's the word I want to say here? My mouth is not working with me. Yes, that's it. Thank you. Yeah. It's late, and my mouth is not working with me here. But you watch something like Night of the Living Dead in black and white. To me, still one of the most chilling movies. I show it to my kids; they're rolling their eyes. When The Exorcist came out, people were blacking out in the theater. They were vomiting. There were reports of people running out of the theater in pure abject terror. And, my teenagers wanted to watch a scary movie. So we all sat down and watched The Exorcist. And three quarters of the way through, when Linda Blair's in full-on freak mode, my kids are like, oh, does this get any better?
Yeah.
And it's just interesting because it's not like they were so inundated with horror. Just because their dad does paranormal radio doesn't mean that I am always surrounded by this. We try to have a normal life. So why is it that what scares one generation is totally, without any kind of consequence to the next? That's so weird to me.
Yeah. So what it is, what we think it is, and what a lot of research shows is that it's a matter of novelty, and also, especially with movies, realism. It's a lot of directors or even haunted attraction designers might think that each generation is becoming less sensitive to things that are violent or gory. But really, it's just the novel aspect of it. What haven't they seen before that is different and new? And we've evolved to pay attention to things that are new and different and to be curious and, try and figure out what's going on. And the issue, though, with a lot of the older movies now is that while kids aren't necessarily growing up with exposure to a lot of scary stuff, there is now a higher threshold for what's considered real versus fake in terms of special effects. And I remember too watching The Exorcist and thinking of her face, you know, all the makeup is being very realistic. But for kids who grow up watching, you know, Avatar or, you know, the hyper-realistic kinds of special effects, I think that there's that is where the threshold has kind of changed. So less about the content, but more about the delivery. And I know that when I work with haunted houses, it really does work to, you know, not say, oh, it has to be more aggressive or more blood or more violence or more gore, but rather just different. You know, what has this generation not seen before, and how can we update it to 21st century technology, but just make it, you know, new and different and still startling and scary, yes, but that doesn't necessarily mean more graphic or violent. So I
think you're right too. And when you know, kids can access YouTube and see a 12-year-old girl start to do her own makeup applications that look worse than anything I've ever seen in a horror movie. And I don't mean just regular. I mean, like the applications they put on to look like a zombie or do this. I guess that does kind of take you out of the mindset of the regular terror. And, you know, maybe there's just enough real things to be afraid of in life now, and school shootings and mass shootings, that, you know, what was terrifying to us in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, or even if you look at the silly costuming from the 50s horror movies, and people were absolutely freaked out by that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Our horror movies are, our scary content is like a mirror to what's happening in society at any given time. When you go back and you look at what people were afraid of during World War I and World War II, and then during the Cold War, a lot of the horror movies reflected those tensions and even the way that we engaged with it. I'm very interested to see, you know, what attendance will look like at haunted attractions this year compared to last year, compared to 5 years ago, as our culture continues to change and in ways that are new and scary. You know, I think that that's a very important thing to kind of think about, because it horror and engagement with scary stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's always responding to time and place. And so I'm very interested to see how that's going to play out with movies and attractions in the coming years. Will people want to engage with it as much if we're feeling more inundated with it on a daily basis? I don't know. And, you know, when I was in Bogota, there's very little attraction and industry around horror. It's there, but it's not popular. So scary movies don't do very well. There's not a lot of haunted houses. And when I talked to the academics and just people in different parts of society there, they all said, you know, why would we want to be scared? We just, you know, you go out on the street and you get scared. There's no desire to go and do that for entertainment. So I'm very interested to see, you know, how things will change in the next few years.
You know, an interesting point being made by one of the listeners on social media, Dimitri, says, what do you think about, you know, not the fear that we're covering, that, you know, the situational fear, but what about the internal unrelenting fear, the dread and kind of doom that psychiatric patients or a PTSD sufferer deals with? It's different, more debilitating and nasty than that momentary fear caused by a physical location, et cetera.
Right, yeah. I spend a lot of time looking at a lot of research with PTSD and the consequences of you know, facing trauma in my book. I think it's chapter 7, but the consequences of trauma that play out in our mind and in our bodies, that they are the mind-body connection is so strong. You know, even though we may, you know that we're safe now, so with PTSD, the incidence of flashbacks or having the overwhelming feeling of re-experiencing the trauma is because our brain and our body are completely intertwined. And it doesn't, you know, I wish that we could say I'm safe now, you know, that was then, this is now, but our body doesn't always get the message. And thankfully, there are many treatments and different approaches to helping work through PTSD, and a lot of research today that's appreciating that, you know, not all PTSD is the same, or not all people's symptoms are the same, and that different approaches might be more helpful for people with different kinds of symptomatology. For example, mindfulness meditation works really well for some. For others, it actually doesn't help at all. So moving towards a more personalized treatment program.
I had, you know, growing up, of course, we're all, you know, kind of put in a position from time to time to see, you know, people taking drugs, doing these things. And, you know, marijuana, I think most of us have experimented with growing up. And I had a friend of mine who was really into acid, and he would always tell me about these remarkable experiences he had and would try to convince me to give it a shot. It's a mind opener and a mind bender. And there were a few times I flirted with the idea because I heard of the effects and the possibilities of kind of opening like a natural DMT window and being able to see and witness things. And then I started watching my friends have these bad trips, as they would refer to them, and terrified. I mean, levels of terror. The one guy I literally had to wrap him up and lay on top of him so that he wouldn't hurt himself, because he was sure there were snakes crawling under his skin. And I thought to myself, man, if that's what's going on with this, there's no chance in hell I'm going to take this on. So I was lucky enough to have had stupid friends do the stupid stuff for me so I could witness it and want nothing to do with bad drugs. But man, that was horrific, an experience for me. That was a fearful moment, because again, how do you rationalize to somebody whose mind is completely gone that what they're experiencing is not real?
Right. Right. And thank God we can learn from other people's experiences.
Yeah.
One of the first functions of telling scary stories is, you know, don't do this. Watch out for, you know, the big monster. But yeah, that's, you know, one of my biggest fears is losing kind of mental capacity, or, you know, not knowing what is real, because from drugs or, you know, disease or anything, but that is truly terrifying. What's really cool, though, is that there's been a lot of research in how to induce altered states naturally. So, you know, doing things like sensory deprivation or different kinds of strobe lighting and meditation or sound, and that you can get into some of those altered states without any pharmacology. Because I agree, you know, you start messing with a lot of the chemicals at different levels, and whew, I would not want to end up in a pit full of snakes.
No, that's that. Yeah, that was what took me out. That and the fact that my buddy gave me this little square of paper. It was like two graph paper squares. And he said, here, take a hit of acid. And I went to throw the whole thing in my mouth. And he said, dude, you're going to kill yourself. That's an overdose. And I looked at him and I saw this little piece of paper. And I said, that's an overdose? And he said, oh, yeah, you gotta rip that up into fourths. And I looked at him and I said, well, how do I know the corner I took didn't get more saturation than the rest? So that fear of drugs, fear of the reaction of what these people were dealing with, kept me from it. And, you know, again, it's life lessons, right? And people that say, oh, well, the bad trips, they're so few and far between. But all you need to do is witness one person having a bad trip to make you realize this is nothing I want to mess with.
Yeah, and that's, you know, all it takes is one bad experience with something, and it can imprint a negative association for our whole life, and especially when we're a kid, like with the garter snake, you know, you just have one bad experience, and that's adaptive. So, you know, we really want to make sure that we remember the things that scared us, that hurt us, so that we don't do it. You know, sometimes that works to our advantage. Other times, you know, we wish we could forget or, you know, not be afraid of something anymore. But exposure therapy can be, you know, super effective for those types of situations. But yeah, we want to make sure that we remember what to watch out for.
Oh, some of the immersion therapy, I'm watching people take snake massages now, where they lay down and snakes are placed on your body. I think just watching the video, I almost had a heart attack. What scares you? We want to talk about that when we return. We'll open up phone lines. You can call in, tell us your chilling encounters, what gets into your head when we return with our guest, Margie Kerr, here on Coast to Coast AM. Margie Kerr is our guest this evening, and we've got phone calls lining up here. If you've got a story to tell, something that's terrified you, or a question for our guest, you can certainly call, and we'll keep that rolling over into the last 2 hours of tonight's show when it's just you and me and this great, big, wonderful world around us listening to the best in overnight talk radio, Coast to Coast AM. Margie, are you ready to go to the phone lines?
I'm ready.
All right, let's go. Wild card line one, Cliff in Bristol, Tennessee. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dave and Margie.
Hey, what did you want to share with us?
Yeah, fascinating show. Very fascinating.
Thank you.
First of all, snakes are cool, okay?
Yeah, the further away from me they are, the cooler they are.
I used to catch them as a kid. I love snakes. I mean, I have no fear of snakes. They're cool. They kill rats. The reason I called was I had a family member. First of all, my family, they're Christian. I'm probably the only one that's not. I'm agnostic. And I had a family member that was going through a rough time and tried to commit suicide through carbon monoxide, you know, car in the garage and all that.
Okay.
And he had a Bible with him, and he, luckily somebody found him before he died, but or didn't die, but he said that he saw images all around him. He didn't know what they were, but he heard whispering. Whispering.
While he was passing, while he was wafting away because of the carbon?
Yes, while he was in the garage. He didn't die, but yeah, he saw these images of, I don't know how to describe it because he couldn't even describe it. But but he heard whispering all around him when this was going on. And that freaked me out. Because, like I said, I'm not a religious person. But that's probably one of the freakiest things I've ever heard. And by the way, the movie Extras, that movie was way ahead of its time.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. God, I've got that movie, and it's awesome. I watch it. It's just something about it. You know?
Yeah, well, it gets into your psyche, gets into your head, and especially when a kid's life is at stake, that always kind of amps up the drama. Thanks for listening and calling in, Cliff. Boy, how about that? Those near death experiences, Margie, where people have, you know, we always hear these, oh, I saw the light and my family came to me. And then there are some that they see things, they hear things.
Yeah.
And that's really dark and twisted. That's terrifying to me.
Yeah, it's when we're in those super high, intensely emotional states, you know, it's surprising and can be frightening what comes up, what our mind is generating, and whether it's, you know, influenced by any kinds of drugs or alcohol. Our brain is going to, you know, generate some stuff we might not expect, and that can be pretty scary.
All right, let's go to our next caller, wildcard line two, JC in Sacramento. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was wanting to tell you that I love to read books, and the only books that I like to read are about serial killers. You know, and that's pretty scary to me. And one author by the are you there?
I'm here.
Yes, okay. We're listening.
One of the authors, Tess Gerritsen, was having an interview. She had some best-selling books, and she wrote about serial killers. And she said that most of the people that read her books were women, and that the women were really scared. And the interviewer said to her, why do you suppose that women would continue to read that kind of scary material? And she said, because it's a safe scare. You know, you're home, and you know, you can get ready to turn the next page and think, oh, no, you know, I'm afraid to turn right. the next page, but you can turn it, but you're safe. So you can
right.
still, yeah, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and in with horror movies and haunted attractions, that's a slight majority of women who like to attend them, and there, I think that is really true, that, you know, women who are afraid of their own safety, afraid of, you know, predators or stalkers, we want to understand, you know, people who might hurt us, and
Absolutely.
Reading books about them is a way of preparing, of studying, of making the unknown and the scary known, and feeling a sense of control, a sense of mastery around it, a sense of, okay, I know what this is, and I know what I can do, and I can confront and overcome in this, you know, like you said, safe space, you know, from a protective distance, not mm-hmm. right up, you know, in direct contact with the scary or the threatening element.
Correct, yes. You got it exactly.
Thank you very much. Thank you for calling in, JC, and listening. Let's go wild card. Line 3, we have Tom in Boise, Idaho. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for taking my call. Margie, very interesting show. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just had a question more about the process of fear, what the long-term effects and stuff. You know, if you have any information on that. And I just wanted to talk real quick about my fear and stuff. And it's just kind of a superficial one, nothing I'm probably going to ever encounter in real life, you know. But I just can't get over just Zach Bagans' nipples poking through his T-shirt on Ghost Adventures.
That's your big fear? Well, the good thing is you can always flip channels. Thanks a lot for calling in. And sharing that, let's go to West of the Rockies, Susie in Hawaii. Welcome to the show.
That was a strange one, wasn't it?
Oh, Susie, it's open phone line night. We're in for all kinds of lunatic calls tonight, but I love that aspect of the show.
This is not a lunatic call.
Well, I'll be the judge of that.
All right. Well, I wish you should have been here, and then you would have you'd have been a lot more afraid of what I was afraid of than you would be snakes.
All right. What have you got?
The night that we got the ballistic missile threat.
Oh, yeah.
Said, this is not a threat. This is real. Take cover immediately. Every time it's on TV, every time they bring it up on the news, I get freaked out and turn it off. It's like, I don't know what PTSD is, but this has to be it. That was the scariest, most horrible. I don't wish it on anybody, but I know other people here feel the same way. We were
yeah.
threatened with imminent death.
Yeah.
Scary.
You know what? And I'm not a clinician, but you might want to check out some of the stories of people who lived through the Blitz in London through World War II, and just some of the stories of people going through the Cold War era, and how they were able to overcome and work through that constant threat of you know, missiles. I've read some of the stories, and it's comforting, and also I think does absolutely help us to read other people's stories about how they experienced it and worked through it, and then see if you know that might help us, because certainly that kind of terror lurking in the background is not something that you should have to carry with you every day.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow, that is, I can't even fathom what that must have been like, that moment to get that message, Susie. How quickly after they released that did they clarify it and clear it up for you guys?
Well, if you had my iPhone went off with all these loud alarms in the morning, which woke us up, and I went and checked it and got the message. But we've downloaded this app from the network. We have a local network. I don't know if I can say it or not, but... Thank God. But their app came on, their alarm came on again like 10 minutes later and said this was a false alarm. If you didn't have the app on your phone, it was like 30 minutes before you knew that it was a false alarm. So there were people just freaking out all over Waikiki and the whole island. I live in Kailua, And I mean, my son lives next door to me and our two grandchildren, and they were all freaking out. We were all calling each other. I call my mother, you call your daughter on the mainland, you call everybody to say goodbye. That's your last, you know, few minutes of life you feel you have. And this was so real because we were getting all these signals from North Korea at the time, and then this happened. And my husband just sat on, he was in shock. He went and sat on the couch, turned on the TV, and he refused to budge. And I was sitting here, I was trying to close all the windows and collect water and, you know, try and store. I was just running around crazy and had the phone in my ear. And he says, it can't be real. It can't be real. And he was just in a complete state of shock. He was just sitting there glued to the television.
You know, there is a PTSD deal that you can do that involves rapid eye movement. And I wish I could remember the name of it right now, but if you look up PTSD and eye movement, there is some, there's some videos online on YouTube that talk about this, and it's stuff that helps to release some of that and to get over some of the PTSD. And I know it's been very successful with war veterans. So it might be something. Yeah.
My daughter, can I tell you one other instance that was really freaky is my daughter, She's a bank teller in Colorado. She was held up at gunpoint twice in a 6-month period, and she was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And both times they held the gun right to her stomach.
Oh,
and she had to give them all the money. I mean, they went to her. She's very small for her age, and they went the smallest teller. And it was a Chase bank. And after the first time, the bank took no precautions to protect their tellers. After the second time, they put up bulletproof shields in front of them. But she's going through major PTSD from that. That was a horrible experience for her.
It's called EMDR, eye movement desensitization. Oh, there's that word again.
EMDR.
Right. E like Edward, M like Mary, D like David, R like Ralph. EMDR. Just Google that and it explains what is EMDR. There are people that can help you with that, but check online. There's some of the video deal too, and I'm not sure on how the science works, but I've heard remarkable results from people that have been utilizing that. So maybe that's something you and your daughter can look into. Thank you so much for listening, Susie. All right, Wildcard Line One, Tim in Georgia. A few minutes left. What did you want to share with us?
Great show. I had something pretty scary happen to me when I was about 18, and I knew my younger brother, I knew that he was involved in some drug activity and stuff, and I was just laying in bed. I had fallen asleep one night, and I was concerned about him, and he had not made it home yet, and I, for some reason, I woke up, and I know I wasn't in a dream or anything. I know I was fully awake, and I looked at his bed, and there was that raised up and actually looked at me, and I tried to scream and vocalize, but my mouth would open, but nothing would come out. It's like my vocal cords were frozen, and I've always wondered if that was the being that caused that or some type of chemical or something in my brain due to the fear that I had that caused that. I was wondering if Mike could touch on that.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be something like sleep paralysis, or when you're not fully awake and you know you don't have full mobility and are in that in between state. And does it happen often, or is it rare?
No, it was just that one time. I've seen the being one other time, but I actually had the boldness to kind of face it and go up against it. But in the first time I saw it, the time I spoke of before, I was awake. I was sitting up in my bed. I looked over. It raised up slowly, looked at me, and I just couldn't speak, couldn't scream. I actually tried to scream, and just nothing would come out. But that's the only time that's ever happened to me.
Fear can have that. It's an immobilization of the vocal cords. They're literally paralyzed. And that's why, you know, I mean, they used to make a joke out of, if you watch the old Abbott and Costello movies, whenever Costello would get afraid, he'd right. He just couldn't muster the sound. And that is a very, natural side effect to fear. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We appreciate that. Wildcard line two, real quickly, Brendan in Seattle. We just have a moment left. What did you want to share with us?
Kind of the same thing to the last caller. Sleep paralysis. That pretty much freaks me out. Multiple times in my life, starting as a young kid. As a young adult, I kind of have a recollection of it. One night, I was having this dream of being a child and kind of standing up in my bed and falling through the hallway to try to get to my parents. And as I got older, it became more lucid and more like in real time. And one common thing is you always have like that dark shadow sometimes against the wall. You can try to confront it. You know, one time getting, you know, for me, it was like anger. If I got angry at this being, I can beat the paralysis, but I would drop to the floor. One time in my apartment, it kind of just shot through the hallway and out underneath the door.
Wow.
Other times, I hate to say this, and it's hard for me to talk about, but if you think of like a stereotypical gray alien that's almond head with the almond eyes and, you know, that there have been multiple times that I've had that kind of figure staying over me, but it's very translucent and it's almost like a sparkle. Give me a sec.
That sounds almost like the mantis head.
Yeah.
Beings.
Kinda. I remember one particular time that I can feel it before it happens. Like the crown of my head will tingle, you know, or I'll hear kind of like a hum as I fall asleep. Then one night I knew it was going to happen. And so I rolled over to not look over the side of my bed, and my bed was in the corner of my bedroom. So I stuck my head, you know, into the corner of my wall. Well, then I heard scratching coming through my wall, and then it basically, the little one kind of popped its head through the
wall. We have to go to a break. If you'd like to hang on, we can hear the rest of the story after the top of the hour. Thank you very much to Margie Kerr, our guest. Open phone lines when we return. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.